Hey, Mr. DJ, put a record on. I wanna dance with my baby.
This is the Best of Public Radio from NHPR. Dr. William Banfield was the featured speaker at the Monadnock Summer Lyceum recently, where he presented a robust thesis on American pop music and its history of engagement. He then opened the floor to questions from the audience, as read by the Lyceum's moderator.
I know you've been involved in conceptualizing music education for the schools, so I'd like to ask you a question about that. Now, I remember a long time ago as a school child, I learned folk songs with stories about Americans, like, say, O Shenandoah, Roland Columbia, 15 miles on the Erie Canal. Now, I've asked my students about this, and none of them know these songs anymore. So although those were transmitted for generations through the schools, I think that's not happening much anymore. And I think the reason for that probably is that those songs were not truly representative of the American experience and thus did not completely address the needs of a diverse and pluralistic society. So my question, there is one in there, Bill, my question is, how can we create a music curriculum that helps children to forge their identities through understanding their cultural inheritance? What role, if any, should school music education play in transmitting cultural values?
It is absolutely critical. And in terms of the direction, I think a lot of us have been working on the transforming of traditional curriculum for a while, as you mentioned. But I just have to say a little bit about Quincy Jones, who is my mentor, and actually who hired me to write a curriculum for the schools. And myself and another mentor, David Baker, and I have been working on this for about the last 5 years. And Quincy Jones's vision was that if every child in America could hear the things that we talked about today, that in fact they would achieve those things in education that you spoke of, particularly in terms of identity and seeing that identity is carried through this music, and also the giving them an opportunity to sing the history of the culture that they live in. Listen, we're the only culture who have forgotten our history. Malcolm X said, those of you who forget your history are destined into it as well, which just means your destruction. So, I mean, this is the key thing that is very, very important, and it can be done in music. So I'm glad you brought that up. But it's difficult to actually put in place because so much of the traditional curriculum is set in stone, and it costs to move that out, and people get offended. They say, now we have to change again? But you're absolutely right. I think all the things, this land is your land, this land is my land, this land was made. I mean, that's like an American song, along with Bob Dylan, along with Aretha Franklin, along with even Beyonce, for that matter. She's got a great tune about singing from the inside right now, and young girls seeing the beauty of themselves. So I think that popular culture can do that. But what happens is we don't recognize popular culture for being of value like that. And the more that we see this going on now, that value in popular culture is being diminished. Look, one of the things I was going to say in my talk was, I don't care about no American Idol. I don't care about no Factor Fabulous. I don't care about your Dancing Gloriously. All of those things have the wrong message. And it's from me. You can quote me. I don't care if they come after me. Which is that at the end of the day, you're voted into for being fabulous, beautiful, or something. But the value of what it took to be there and get there is what's not celebrated. And by the way, you and 50 million other Americans get to push the button for the cutest kid from your neighborhood that you think is the greatest American Idol. Now, that's community building. I get that. But I'm seeing also a part of that, and that's good. But there's some problems with the way in which music and culture has been so manufactured in the culture today that everything is push button. And so young people want to emulate and get to the goal, which is get to the gold, which is get to the money. And that never, that's a problematic and poisonous formula for art and culture. I know I'm preaching, but I am in a church, so it's okay.
Yes, sir. Okay, well, we got a couple of questions here that involve the generational differences, shall
yes,
we say.
Yes,
one is, my children love hip-hop, I don't get it. What can I read and listen to so I can get it? And the second question is related. If we can't understand the words, how does modern pop music send a message?
Boy. Again, I'm not going to be an old fogey today. I have to also jump on the side of defending the good music that's out there, and there's a lot of it. To your point, dear colleague out there, wherever you are, there's a song for you by a hip-hop group, and it's called Parents Just Don't Understand. It's by Will Smith. Remember that song? It is a banner just for you. And you should listen to that. So start with that one because you can laugh about this. And that's about early 90s, late 80s, I think. Parents just don't understand. But with hip-hop, let's defang that great music movement for a minute. Hip-hop culture was started in New York brought here, by the way, not by New Yorkers, but by Jamaicans who had a tradition of toasting, which was to talk about communal issues and to talk about it with big loudspeakers so everybody could party outside. Okay, that tradition, a guy named Kool Herc moved to the Bronx, 70-71, and because the disco culture became in the late 70s began to be so expensive, the community people couldn't afford to go to the disco clubs anymore. So they decided to do it in the streets. They would take their turntables and plug them in to the lamppost. Let's talk about American innovation, okay? And what they did was they had block parties, so everybody could have disco like the rich people did in Manhattan. And the people that were a part of that first original group of hip-hoppers were people who were concerned about the community. They were concerned about the death of the community. They were concerned about the life of the community. And their rhymes were incorporated to be focused on that. So you really need to understand that hip-hop is actually a champion at the same time as grunge and rock and punk music, which was also about the same time. It was young people taking a grittier music and addressing social issues. That is the foundational root of hip-hop culture. Make no ifs or buts about it. You can listen to It's Like a Jungle Sometimes. It makes me wonder how I think that I'm going under. I mean, this is a great tune from 1981. So to your question, we're now dealing with hip-hop culture in about 40 years of music. It's amazing. We thought it would go away. It ain't gone away. It's been here for a long time, and there are great cores of meaning and texts that are there. So to the question, there are a lot of books, not here to sell a bunch of books, but that deal with breaking down the poetry so that you can hear the words. With all the technology and the sound, you can't hear it. But like I say, to be a good archaeologist, because guess what? You may not be listening to what the word's saying, but guess who is? The kids. The kids get it. And there's a lot of good messages. There's a lot of problematic stuff, but you hear the problematic complaint all the time. I don't want to represent that because I do that a lot. You know, I mean, I'm always down on hip-hop. I shouldn't be, because it is a powerful form. It's just used in an irresponsible way, okay? We're still in church, so I get to preach a little bit, you know. But there's a lot of good hip-hop out there. And you're right, in terms of popular music, there are good singers. And we have singer educators here who train these singers to enunciate the words clearly, to have a sense of self in the song, to deal with the narrative of the song. So we hear that Commodores, you know, Lionel Richie thing again, where you hear verses and people are talking to each other. It really is out there, but you have to be a good, patient steward and student of your culture. You got to shake it out a little bit, and gold is there for sure.
I believe we have time for one more question, and there's one here that is at the same time very simple and very complicated. How can we take the music back?
I'm going to defer this question to this great group of artists who we have here. We have Charles Bruchel from New Orleans, and Charles is just graduated with his master's from Harvard in education. So since he just came from Harvard, that makes him the smartest man in the room.
Okay, well, can you repeat the question again? I believe I heard it, but I just want to make sure, since I'm now the smartest man in the room, I want to...
How can we take the music back?
All right, how can we take the music back? Well, that's a hard question to answer. I guess the first thing is who has the music and who are we taking it back from? Are we taking it back from the big corporations that run the music industry? Are we taking it back from the internet and digital downloading and all these things that have kind of redefined the musical landscape? Like, who are we taking it back from? Are we taking it back from the people, you know, in the offices who say, this person is fit to be a star, this person's fit to be an artist, this person does not, because you don't fit the right image? And I guess that's the question that I'm always thinking about, too, because my parents are from an older generation, and I grew up listening to music from the 50s and 60s, and that was the music I grew up on, as well as hip-hop and all the current things that, you know, people my age and younger consume. So for me, I always exist with this kind of dichotomy of understanding what, you know, my current, what the current musical and cultural landscape is for my generation, but also understanding what came before and having a great appreciation for this. But I think the thing that we can't avoid is that the musical landscape is different now. With the internet, everything has changed, which is bad and good, because now independent artists have a voice, which in the past they didn't. If you weren't signed by the record label, if you didn't have the right A&R person, nobody heard your music. But now you can take a song, you can put it on the internet, and everyone can see it. So there is a, I think the bright side is that because there's this kind of free roaming place where you can put music, you have, you know, there's more of an opportunity for other voices to get out there that are not controlled by these mega corporations and things like that. The only issue is because we have this landscape, there's so much to now navigate through. So, you know, it's, you have to become a researcher and you have to, you know, really find and investigate. So then what happens is what you have now are what are called music blogs, which basically tell people what to listen to and tell people this is good and this is bad. And they are kind of the cultural gatekeepers now to tell you this is the music you should be listening to. So now the goal is, okay, you're an independent artist, you make music, but how can you get people to pay attention to it? How can you get these blogs to write about it? So taking the music back is an interesting challenge, because people, I believe, do have more power now. You can support an independent artist. You can come to a lecture series and hear artists perform and say, hey, I like your music. Where can I get your CD? Or you can go online and say, hey, I like this. I'm going to play this. I'm going to go to their website. So the landscape has changed, and it's a very positive thing, but it's also one that leaves us concerned, because within this, you know, artists are also have less power. With streaming and downloading all these things, musicians actually make less and less money from their music. I heard the reports on how much a person makes from one play on Spotify, and it's not very much. But the person who owns Spotify and Pandora and all these streaming websites, for those who might not be familiar, Pandora and Spotify are places where you can just listen to endless catalogs of music, basically for free or for a small subscription price. The person, I believe it's the person who runs Pandora, makes $1 million a month. While each artist, not their record label, but just the artist, makes less than 1 cent per play of their song. So all the work that you've done to create this thing is now benefiting somebody else who has just provided a platform for people to hear it. So to make this short, the only way that we can take the music back is for more people to support independent artists and to support the people who are really trying to do, you know, really inspiring music. I'm an independent artist.
To listen back to Banfield's lecture and other lectures from the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, visit nhpr.org. And you can attend future lectures in person at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough. Next week, Bernd Heinrich discusses how the natural world offers solutions to many of mankind's problems. That's next Sunday night at 9 on the Best of Public Radio from NHPR. For the